You are now online with Andrea, with your host, Andrea Garrison.
Good afternoon. Welcome. You are now online with Andrea. I am your host, Andrea Garrison, and I'd like to encourage all of our listeners to practice the universal law of giving by doing whatever you can to reach out to help others. Our topic today is the book, Ancestral Medicine, Rituals for Personal and Family Healing. And our guest is author, Dr. Daniel Four. Hello there. How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you, Andrea. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So I was very excited about talking to you. When I heard the title, I was intrigued. And what a fascinating topic. And if I could start by just reading a paragraph from your book. It says, and it's in the introduction, and it says, when you think of the ancestors, who or what comes to mind? Ancestors are a biological and historical reality for each of us, irrespective of our religious, racial, or cultural backgrounds. Your blood lineage ancestors include the thousands of women and men whose lives weave a story back to the first human beings in Africa over 200,000 years ago. Even if you were adopted or orphaned and will never know your biological parents, the ancestors still speak through the DNA in each cell of your body. They are reflected in your physical features, your health, and many of your predispositions. Beyond your bloodlines, you might also claim as an ancestor anyone whose life has inspired you, either personally or culturally. This list might include extended and adoptive family, beloved friends, and well-known people who touched your lives before their passing. Wow. So tell me, when did you realize the importance of ancestral medicine, and what inspired your interest in writing a book about ancestral medicine?
Sure. My own ancestry of blood are early English, German, Irish colonizers, settlers to North America, Western Pennsylvania, and Ohio. And I wasn't raised with any framework for relating with them directly in spirit. That came as a late teenager, as someone interested in paganism, shamanism, ritual, things like that. And so I was exposed early on to a framework for relating with the spirits of animals and plants and the natural world. And then also introduced to a framework for relating with my blood ancestors directly in spirit. And that seed really germinated strongly for me and helped me to reassess my own judgments that I had of my family growing up, and helped me to see that there's beauty and strong magic and healing and blessing that I inherit just by virtue of being who I am. And that's true for everyone, but I had never seen value so strongly in my own family until seeing my family in a much more intergenerational context that comes through relating with the ancestors. And then that led me, after 6-7 years of being immersed in that kind of ritual work for myself, to start to support others in that work maybe 15 years ago. And then in the last 15 years, I went on to become a doctor of psychology and a licensed therapist, but mostly I've been guiding ritual work, and a lot of that is focused on helping people that have healing with their blood lineage ancestors. And so the book is an outgrowth of that kind of ministry or ritual undertaking that has been so much a part of my life in the last 15 years.
Yeah.
So in that way, the book's written as it's a manual, it's a guidebook. It's not just like, hey, go ancestors. It's like, if you're drawn to engage directly with your own ancestors, here's how to do that safely and systematically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a guidebook.
Yeah, I like the fact that you go beyond the blood relative to the extended family, because I know that for myself, I've met people who are not blood relatives, but they felt like they were. You know, it's just we had such a connection. I mean, it's almost like we really were blood relatives. So I think it's wonderful that you extend that, you know, by saying that that it could also be someone that inspires you, or maybe someone you don't know. It's just, I guess it's sort of like an inner connection, correct, that you have.
Yeah, it's inner in a sense, but in another sense, it's actually distinctly not. I mean, in the sense that our interaction right now is not just an inner connection. There's a way in which you exist and I exist and we're interfacing, right?
Right.
And so the basic premise of ancestor reverence and ritual from whatever cultural background is that, you know, although we may be connected to our ancestors through some common deeper root that we both share, that they have a kind of existence distinct from us and vice versa. So it is more of a relational interaction with the ancestral souls or spirits as they exist in the present.
Yeah.
Our memories of people who have died are just that, they're memories. That's not bad. They may be very powerful and meaningful. But who was alive on Earth is different than who we're relating with in the present, because they continue to change and evolve and grow. And so some people who are quite troubled or not very enjoyable to be around during life can actually work it out after death and become a lot better condition.
Yeah.
So that then continues to change. And so it is relational in that way.
Yeah.
And we can have meaningful connections with ancestors that we're associated with through spiritual practice, through geography, so ancestors of land, through vocation, through adoptive or chosen family, and also of blood, all of the above.
Yeah. Now, you talk about being grounded in your relationships with your ancestor. How does one develop a relationship with those from the past who have moved on beyond the physical body?
Sure. There's all kinds of ways to actually step into the direct relating. The first thing, as simple as it sounds, is to have a basic framework for those relationships. So one of the things we've already said is that they exist in the present. And so you're relating with the ancestral souls and spirits that previously were incarnate on Earth, but dwell in the present now. And another important principle is that not all the dead are equally well. So just like, think of living humans. If I said, hey, let's go relate with some living humans, you'd be like, wow, that's kind of weird. Like, are they friendly? And it's like that with the ancestors as well. Just dying doesn't make you wise and loving and kind. It just means you're not incarnate anymore. And so it's important to have a sense of real discernment. So if you put out an intention, I want to connect directly with my ancestors, I would say, put out the intent to connect directly with your wise, loving, kind, supportive ancestors, those among the dead who can help you to remember yourself, to be healthy, protected, fulfill your destiny, those kinds of things. So the way that can show up can be through dreams, through synchronicities, through a direct feeling of being in touch with them, kind of visions, trance work. It can happen in lots of different states of consciousness, really, in an ordinary, everyday way, or in a kind of cracked open way, like near-death experiences or visionary experiences. So it really depends on the individual and how their intuition functions. But I'll say that reclaiming our capacity to navigate those kinds of relationships is needed because of cultural damage, because we haven't been raised to value those connections. Mm. It's not that different from understanding we can talk to plants or to the land where we're at, or to rivers or to the ancestors, right?
Yeah.
So that's a capacity most humans throughout the history of our species have held as normal. So it's something we can reclaim if we wish to.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of benefits to ancestry work. You say that ancestral work encourages introspection and greater clarity about life's purpose.
Yeah, I see it that way. It's my view, as is the case for a lot of different cultures, some indigenous, and that each of us has a unique destiny. We have unique gifts to bring to the world, original instructions. Kind of, you can talk about it in different ways, personal medicine, but it's not the same for each person. And so it's a really relevant question of, what am I specifically doing here? It's not like, why are humans on Earth, but it's, why am I specifically here? What did I come here to take care of? And the ancestors are connected to that because we're inseparably connected to them. And they can help us to remember what we're doing here. Because a lot of what we're doing here is playing out intergenerational stories from our bloodlines. That's a part of it. Not the whole story, but it's a part of it. And to live a meaningful life is actually really, it should be high priority. I mean, some people get stuck in living a comfortable life or an acceptable life, but a lot of people, when they're being honest with themselves, want a meaningful life that has a sense of soul and spirit and purpose to it. And so it makes sense to ask, who can help in that remembering? Well, the ancestors are invested in us. We're their blessed children. They want us to do well. It reflects well on them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Now, you say that the pain of our ancestors can endure through generations. If you can just kind of elaborate on that, because I'm wondering about people who are experiencing some sort of physical pain right now or emotional pain. Could this be something that's been passed down? I mean, I know when you get into genetics, but I mean, even beyond that, if you can just talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I do have the view that we are way less individual than we often perceive ourselves to be, and that a lot of the grief or pain or trauma or difficulty, as well as the blessings to a degree, I mean, there's also intergenerational blessings, of course, but a lot of the trouble that we carry is ancestrally inherited. And you know, speaking also as a licensed therapist and as a doctor of psychology, it's my take on mental health that a lot, like more than half, of what people struggle with is either intergenerational pain and trouble that comes directly through family of origin stuff or indirectly through blood, body, you could say genetic, I suppose, intergenerational influence, or some of it's direct interference from the dead who are not yet well. The troubled dead, the ghosts, the ones who die but they don't transition, and they hang out around people because
yeah.
they haven't died. And so it's real. It's real. I mean, I say that as a privileged American white guy, and I wasn't raised with it, but I've done a lot of inquiry around it, trained with different, you know, spiritual healers, teachers around the world, and most people on Earth see it like this, and the dead continue to have influence.
Yeah.
And when they're not well, that influence can be unhelpful. When they are well, it can be very helpful and very enlivening in a good way.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking as you were speaking, you know, I guess many people who are listening have heard someone say in their life that they don't want to have anything to do with their family. Nothing. Totally cut them off. But it's not realistic. You can't really escape that, your family, can you?
Well, the way to, no, you can't anymore. And the way to try to escape them is to die. But even that, then you really don't have a buffer. But the body level, like blood and bones that we are, is an inherent link with our ancestors. And so you can't shake your ancestors any more than, you know, there's a structure like a branch shaking the roots of the tree. You can't exist apart from that matrix of energy. That doesn't mean that you have to just suffer or fail to have a boundary with them. The dead who are not yet well, it's important to have a boundary with them. And the real work, or the real... the real sort of revenge in a good way is to heal them up. And so the ones who are not yet well get what they need. And then the trouble that we've been running from isn't there in the same way. And that's what I've been doing pretty much full time for the last 15 years, is guiding people through blood lineage ritual work to heal up painful legacies ancestrally.
Yeah.
Because the dead continue to change. And you can spend years trying to have a boundary with them, or you can do 6 months of focused work to actually help the troubled dead to become ancestors. And then you, not only do you need not need a boundary, you can be in relationship with the ones who are now well.
Yeah, yeah, that's beautiful. So tell us, so how did you begin the process of learning about your ancestors? And tell us a bit about your initial contact. And if you don't mind, give us a brief summary of your personal journey to get to know and to love your family ancestors.
Yeah, sure. I did some genealogy research. My family's, I didn't inherit a lot of that knowledge growing up. So I had to search about it and interview extended family and whatnot. And I'm fortunate. I don't come from a particularly fractured or divided family like a lot of people. And so, yeah, I got to interview at least one grandparent and other extended family, which was good. And I did a lot of my own therapy and healing work and looking at patterns and whatnot. But then ritually speaking, I was asked to work to drop in and connect with an older ancestor, which I did, in my father's lineage. And throughout that day of ritual, this was over, you know, 20 years ago now, I ended up meeting in spirit with my father's father, who took his own life, shot himself, and he was not yet well in spirit. And in that day of ritual, this much older ancestor brought healing to my grandfather and helped him to transition to really finally join the ancestors, because he was in a, it's like a ghost state or an in-between state. He had died, but he hadn't really arrived to the realm of the ancestors yet. And so that was very impactful for me. I hadn't considered the need for that. The implications were, you know, reverberated through my life and set me on a journey to get to know my other ancestral lineages as well. And that's the process that's present in the book. And it's a lineage-based approach, basically. And what that means, for me at least, is how I hold it, is that includes getting to know much older ancestors who lived before historical records, before colonialism, before Christianity, Islam, Judaism, whatever the traditions are that maybe don't have a real proactive habit of tending to these relationships. And those older ancestors who, when they were alive on Earth, were taking care of these relationships between the living and the dead, those ones are important and beneficial to call in. And getting to know them, for me, as a culturally disconnected American white guy, was very restorative. I'm like, oh, there are indigenous earth-honoring cultures of Europe that I can contact directly in the present, in spirit, in a way that is nourishing, in a way that I feel seen by. And so getting to know my much older ancestors in spirit was the way that I really went from accepting my ancestors to loving them, like, in a big way, and feeling inspired by them.
So you would say then, So your life changed tremendously, and you would say that you became more loving because of it, because of this work?
Yeah, I think so. I certainly became easier to be around in my family because I wasn't being judgy toward my family. And it's helped me to see other people's annoying qualities in a softer way, because I can see how pretty much everybody is playing out intergenerational trouble.
Yeah.
And we're down lineage from all kinds of different problems like that. And I am involved in cultural healing work and, you know, the way that I train people. So that includes looking at legacies around racism, sexism, colonialism, discrimination toward LGBTQ people, etc. And it is easy in that terrain to get polarized. Be like, oh, these are the bad, racist, sexist, whatever people, and I'm not one of those people. And it's not actually that constructive as a stance. It projects the shadow outside of ourselves, or this, or the unconscious kind of ways of being, and it fails to see the people that are acting badly in the moment as acting out this bigger systemic problem that we're all connected to.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so the ancestors have helped me to see the troubles that we're trying to deal with more systemically. And in that way, I think to be more skillful at loving people, because they're not seen in an isolated way. Yeah.
Now, how important is forgiveness in the healing process?
It's important, and it's important that there be safety and different conditions before engaging in that. Just like you wouldn't ask someone in a domestic violence relationship to engage in forgiveness while they're still being abused. And you would first establish safety and then seek forgiveness. And so, no generalizing, in the United States, this history of this nation is a double genocide toward African and Native peoples. And so, on the one hand, there's a lot of healing and forgiveness and emotional healing, family healing, that is always and already has been taking place and is relevant in an ongoing way, period.
Yeah.
And also, because there's ongoing injustice, and ongoing fresh new harms and a lack of repair for past harms, it's not possible to jump to forgiveness. There needs to be justice, and not in a vindictive way, but in a systemic fairness kind of way. And so in that sense, you can't jump to forgiveness when there hasn't been a repair first.
Mm.
So both things are true. We need to find our wellness, even within imperfect conditions, or else we're going to spend our whole life being miserable. And also, there's a need for greater fairness and healing and accountability. So I think those are simultaneously true.
Yeah. So how do we distinguish between recent family ancestors and the older collective dead? And how do you tell the difference between healthy ancestors and ghosts?
Sure. One thing that I've been focused on is, partly because I've been unable to meet the need, is training others in how to guide this work. And so on my website, which you mentioned, there's a directory of practitioners for this work. And I mention that only because right at the start, for folks who may be called to engage, it's relevant to have a little bit of guidance and support. Like, you could teach yourself how to scuba dive, but as an activity, it's one of those things that you benefit from a little bit of lesson up front, and then you're probably good to go. So there are a few ritual skills that are relevant to have support in reclaiming. But as for how you discern the difference between those who are well and those who are not well, a first thing is knowing that we do that all the time with living humans. And sometimes our intuition is off, but mostly if you're looking around, you're going to be able to tell like, something's off about this person. Or like, God, I just get a really nice feeling. Like, they seem like a really good person. And often it's a little bit in between, but those same instincts that we have around discerning safety and good character can be extended to our experience of people who are not incarnate, ancestors, you know, deities, angels, animal spirits, whatever, you know, whatever it is. The universe is full of many kinds of intelligence that are not human. And if we're going to navigate those relationships, then we need to also rely on our instinct about, is this healthy? Is this feel safe? Or not so much.
Yeah.
Most of the time, our instincts will lead us well. And as for connecting with the older ones, that's an important distinction, because a lot of people in this culture, if I say think of your ancestors, they're going to think of the last 3 to maybe 10 generations of people, some of whom they might have black and white pictures for, but there's a sense almost that the ancestors stop there. And I'm suggesting include at least the last 2,000 years.
Wow.
Which is just less than 1% of our history as a species.
Yeah.
And so those ones in spirit, on a lineage level, they're like a group or collective energy. We're like a bee that's like maybe met one other bee, and then you meet 3 bees, and you're like, oh, it must be a hive. And those bees are like, nah, well, let us show you. Come with us. Let us show you something. And so, like, oh, my God, I'm connected to this whole bigger system, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, now, in your book, it states the dead are not dead and that consciousness continues after death.
Yeah, it's like that. We, by dead in English, we typically mean not relating. And so in modern American culture, we would often describe stones or mountains as dead, for example.
Right.
Or they're not a source of relationship. Well, that just means that you don't know how to speak to them.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean that they're not capable of communicating. And so what we really mean is dead to me when we say dead in English.
Yeah.
And so that says more about the one labeling another as that often than it does about the one who could potentially communicate. Mm. And so as soon as we open ourselves to the possibility of relating with the ancestors, we realize they're quite alive in the sense that they can relate. Now, if you mean incarnate versus not incarnate, well, sure, that's a relevant distinction. They're not incorporated. They're not in the body in the same way. So
yeah.
Sometimes you mean that. People also mean that when they say dead.
Yeah.
But mostly they mean not capable of relating, and that's just not accurate. Like in all ancient Egyptian cultures, at some point at least, the dead were described as the living ones, and like implying that they're more alive than the ones here. Because to the ancestors, we look like we put on these really dense, kind of magical, but dense body spacesuits for a walk in Earthland. And then, then we get to relax a bit after we die.
It's funny. I'm listening to you talk. I was thinking about this guitarist that I met, who's pretty, you know, he's played with a lot of, major acts. So he's pretty renowned, you know, within the guitarist circle. And I remember him telling me that when he was a young child learning guitar, that a famous guitarist who had passed away came in and taught him some things that he did not know about the guitar, and showed him how to do some things. And I was, for some reason, I was just thinking that just popped into my head as you were speaking about how consciousness continues and
just because we're not conscious of our ancestors doesn't mean we don't enjoy a lot of connection with them.
Right.
The many people who are quite successful, their success is in part a function of unconsciously embodied ancestral blessings and support. And when people get in a really tapped in groove in their whatever they do. Sometimes it's because they're unconsciously channeling the ancestors, and they might describe that as a state of flow or being on point or however they talk about it. But sometimes we are drawing on our blessings unconsciously.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was just thinking how powerful that was, that he obviously had so much respect for that guitarist, that the guitarist actually reached out, you know, here to him, here to teach him. That's amazing. I thought that was just an amazing story.
Well, it is. Yeah, it's great. And it happens all the time without being recognized. Once we have a framework for the reality of the ancestors and just how influential they are here, then we can stop and say, oh, thanks. Thanks for my life. Thanks for all the ways you've been looking out for me. Thank you.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Now, you say that the contact between the living and the dead can take on many forms. So what, if you could talk about the different forms, and what are some of the ways that the living and dead communicate? I'm not sure I should be using the word dead now, because dead doesn't necessarily, I'm thinking about your definition.
I know what you mean. I get it. I mean, it's kind of poetic. It has a lot of charge to it, but, and also the dead are not dead. So
the living dead, so, maybe.
Yeah, well, it's different. But you know, the ancestors and the ones here. Right. Yeah. There's all kinds of ways. So as we mentioned earlier, dreams, synchronicities, where you just have a powerful event happen, and being in a shifted, altered state, and like having a near-death experience and visiting with your people, and then you come back, can be dramatic like that. But for a lot of people, it's an everyday kind of thing. You just sense them present with you, and then they're less present. There's a feeling of contact for a moment. And some people, of course, have an active devotional practice with their ancestors. They have an ancestor altar, prayers they do, ritual they do. You know, I happen to be an initiate in West African Orisha tradition or Yoruba traditional religion, and an initiate in the Ancestral Medium Society in that culture. And so there are ways in which we very intentionally call the ancestors to be present. But aside from that, there's just a kind of stance of walking with them, allowing them to companion us, allowing them to inform our everyday lives and choices and instincts. Maybe we set out an offering for them, maybe we don't. But there's a sense that our life, that we're the mask that they're wearing, and that the bee has access to the hive and knowledge of the hive, and that we're an extension of their consciousness here on Earth.
Yeah.
So that can show up in a very organic way that people don't even notice on the outside. It's just a way of being with them.
So we help each other, right? We can help them. They can help us.
That's right. Yeah. Like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And some people, at least in Yoruba culture, will describe the trip to the earth as a trip to the marketplace. And you don't come to the marketplace just to loaf around, typically. You come here to sell some stuff, to buy some stuff. And then when you come home, if people are like, well, how'd it go? And you're like, oh, yeah, I went to the market. I forgot my shopping list. Sorry. The ancestors are going to be like, really? We sent you all the way to the market, and you didn't even, like, remember your shopping list? But if you're like, oh, I learned some stuff, I helped some people, some stuff happened, then that's interesting. You have an interesting debrief with them when you die.
Yeah. Now, in your book, it says, death in our world is the start of a rite of passage for the recently deceased. This journey is completed only when they fully join the ranks of ancestors. The living can play an important role in this transformation. And I guess that's, we're helping each other, which is very powerful. It's not just them reaching out. It's a constant exchange. I guess a or just going back and forth, right? Give and take.
It's true. The, you know, when a human comes here, it takes a minute for them to be able to be useful and of service, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't expect our 7-month-old daughter to help with too much yet. And when someone just dies, well, it doesn't take quite as long as it would with a baby, but when someone just dies, they're in a catalytic process of transformation and change to become an ancestor, hopefully. And we do have an important role to play in that process. That usually shows up through the funerary rites, the death rituals, and making sure that people are loved well, that they have a good send-off, that their burial or cremation or whatever it is done well, and that we honor their stages after the death of the body to become a well-seated ancestor. Because our funeral rites, at least in, you know, in the West and the United States and beyond, often don't really take into consideration the journey of the soul. They sometimes do, but often don't. Then that important function breaks down a bit, and then you get more people among the dead who haven't actually transitioned very well.
Yeah.
So just dying doesn't make you an ancestor. It just means you're not incarnate.
You know, and I was thinking, just talking to you and thinking about your book, you're bringing all these things into my consciousness. Now, I was thinking, when I was a little girl, this four-year-old girl died suddenly. Beautiful, beautiful child. But there was something so special about this child. She seemed like she was a very, very old soul, and that she just came here with more knowledge than the average soul, shall I say. And what brought her to mind is when you said you don't necessarily expect a 7-month old child to know us, you know, or have that deep connection or understanding. But I wonder about this. Some children just seem to be so beyond their age, you know, even from birth, wouldn't you say? It's like they maybe they can't speak it, but they know, or they're...
For sure. The other side of what I said is that the souls that are returning in the bodies of little babies are not baby souls. They're adult souls, so to speak. Or they run a wide variety or spectrum of levels of development, but some of the souls that are coming back are their big presences. Now, they still have to learn how to tie their shoes and to talk and to navigate elementary school and all that. So it's a funny thing to watch the forgetting of the big soul, or it starts to become filtered through the consciousness of the child, which has to catch up, hopefully.
Yeah, like the babies come in knowing how to swim and knowing how to breathe properly, but yet they start breathing improperly, right? Or a lot of them do, and then a lot of them don't realize that they can swim. It's kind of interesting.
Right. You know, the ones that are returning come with a lot of implicit knowledge, and it's our responsibility as the care providers to nurture that along and bring that out without squelching the inherent soul-level wisdom that the ones that the ancestors are returning with. The children are the ancestors returned. And so one of the ways we take care of the ancestors is to honor the children.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. That's really beautiful. So let's talk about someone who has limited memories of their ancestors. If you don't really have any memories, and say you're adopted, and you can't really talk to family members like you were able to talk to, your family. So
What? Yeah, that would be most people. Well, not most people that are adopted, but many people have a limited knowledge of their family history, and some people have a very truncated knowledge of their recent blood ancestry because of adoption or loss of parents or conception through violence or whatever the circumstances might be. And it doesn't need to function as a barrier to relate directly with your ancestors of blood.
Yeah.
I've stepped many adoptees through that work, and there's a need to trust your intuition and your instinct about things. But compare, metaphorically, standing at the beach at the ocean, somebody who has a lot of knowledge of history might be able to see to the horizon, which is about 30 miles. And somebody who's, you know, will never know the names of their parents, it's like fog at the beach. But if the person who sees the 30 miles out thinks that they understand the ocean, they're confused because they really just see this little sliver at the beach.
Right.
So the both people, both individuals in this metaphor have inherent access to the much, much bigger field of energy that is the ancestors.
Yeah. Now, you also talk about the out of Africa theory, and that all of our human ancestors originate in ancient Africa. And that there is a connection between all of us in Africa. Would you like to elaborate on that a little bit?
That's my understanding of the human biology and history.
Right.
It's been, even just 50,000 years ago, I believe that all Homo sapiens are, you know, originating in the continent of Africa. You know, it doesn't mean everybody's culturally African, of course, but especially because of the history in the last 500 years of European colonialism and arrogance and racism, it's important. There's a benefit to recognizing that everybody shares a common root on the continent, and to have a... Well, I mean, does that translate into a healthy respect for Africans, African Americans? Maybe. I mean, I suppose it's a little bit of a snub to people who would have some sort of awkward, like, white pride or something. But so I'd like to repeat it just to be difficult to those kinds of people. And there's a benefit to remembering our shared humanity as well.
Yeah.
And even though there's a beauty in ancestral diversity, there's also a fundamental connectedness that we share with one another and relative to the rest of the natural world.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Now, when you establish a connection and communication with your ancestors, how do you know that you're not making this up? And how does one distinguish between talking to spirits and, say, psychosis or, I don't know, imagination or whatever?
But, sure. The last question's easier in the sense that most of the time actual psychosis is pretty recognizable. Not always, but, you know, there's a lot of gray territory, and what we describe as psychosis could at times be a cultural judgment of actual spirit contact, and sometimes it's actual, you know, just real disturbance that doesn't involve a lot of spirit contact. So that's a nuanced topic, but the short answer is usually you can tell the difference when someone's having a psychotic break and when they've just been contacted by their grandmother. And how we tell the difference between making it up and actually having contact is it's a nuanced topic. And it requires recommending a framework for this type of stuff. And it's not that different from how do we know that we're actually in connection with somebody versus just projecting onto them. You know, often there's an instinctual feeling of contact or feeling of intimacy or meeting another person that we can detect when it's working. But that's just one factor. And everybody's intuition, everybody's style for navigating these relationships is a little bit different. Some people might sense things visually. Other people might have a body feeling about it. Other people might hear as if they're speaking. It's like a clairaudience, with their intuition is more audio. So part of the practice is learning how does it show up for you in particular, and experimenting and trusting that over time.
Yeah. Now, you say that one common fear is not being able to close a door once it is opened. So what if you learn about your ancestral history, but you choose not to connect or open the door to communication? And if you close the door and choose to reconnect at a different time, is it possible to do so? Once you close it, can you reopen it?
Yeah, sure. Typically, of course. I mean, they're not going anywhere. Like, the door is going to open when you die anyways, because you're part of that system. So you can potentially keep the door bolted shut until you die. And then there's nowhere to hide from the bigger system that you're a part of. But if you don't wish to have direct spirit contact with them, that's fine. You can still do things to convey respect and acknowledgement to them. So that's good. And you can ask the intensity of that connection be regulated so it's not overwhelming, and that they bring blessing and ease and protection and guidance into your life, healing.
Yeah.
So it's possible to approach safely. That's one of the reasons I encourage folks to do a few sessions with people trained in this work, so that the approach is supportive and safe and gentle.
Yeah.
Sometimes there is a lot of compressed or unaddressed kinds of energies that are on the other side of that, contact boundary.
Yeah. So would you say in most cases, the connection is via the dream state? The connection with our ancestors.
Not really. I don't tend to have a lot of dreams of my ancestors. Some people have that. For most people, I think it's like if you wanted to connect with your ancestors, Andrea, we could drop in the next 5-10 minutes and be there. Like, it's not that hard. They're available.
Yeah.
It doesn't require being special. It doesn't require being super spiritual. It doesn't require like being psychic or any of that.
Is it better to just think, rather than think that they're far away, is it easier to connect when you realize or think, they're really right here?
That's right. That helps. Yeah. And being clear about your intention, and that you like understanding why you want to connect with them, and being open and vulnerable and allowing in their help.
Yeah.
So to actually want the connection, they're like, oh, well, we're going to do this. And so they'll respond to people who are sincere. There might be a little bit of effort up front just to reclaim the framework and the ability to do the connection. But after that, people tend to be pretty good to go. I mean, I've stepped a few thousand people through this work in the last 15 years, and I don't say it's easy, but the ancestors are quite available. There's reason to be encouraged about that, or to feel hopeful about it.
Yeah. So someone who wants to initially start getting into this, what would you suggest to them? Would suggest that they contact some of the practitioners on your site to get started?
That's a great and efficient way to dive in. Another is to check out the book. And another is to check out the online course starting in October and how to engage the work. There are other talks on my site. And so there are a lot of different pathways or avenues to connect. If people are skittish or reluctant to dive all the way in, then just honor the intellectual curiosity and go from there. But if people are like, oh, this has already been happening, I want support around it, then yes, set up a session with somebody.
Yeah.
And let someone be supportive to you and step you through it.
So how important is it to let your heart be your guide and trust your instincts?
Medium important. Like, I wouldn't want, if I were learning how to drive a truck or fly a plane, I wouldn't want my heart to be my guide only. I would want to, like, know the safety controls and all that. And so it's about as important as it is with dating, let's say. You can let your heart be your guide, and that's super important to have your heart engaged, but having done some good therapy and having good discernment about character and having your friends meet the person and being steady or cautious at first, those things can be important too. So it's okay to have a little bit of a ethic of caution or suspicion, but to still engage.
Yeah.
Yeah, so a bit of both. And, of course, bring our heart to the matter. It's just that it's there's also things to know and be aware of too.
So this is really important work in terms of the what it means, not only for the past, the present, but also the future. Because if we aid in the healing of our ancestors, and they in turn aid in the healing of us, then it is possible for us to soften and aid the healing process in future generations, right?
Oh, yeah. That's what's fueling my job security. It's true. I mean, I'm only half joking about that. A lot of the trouble that we're in on Earth is human behavior trouble. And human behavior problems don't come out of nowhere. They're intergenerational problems. And they're problems that we're down lineage from because the ancestors created them during their time on Earth.
Yeah.
And now we're recreating them or not. And many of the ancestors that created those problems are now remorseful about it and working to try to repair them. So it's important, if possible, that we work in partnership with the ancestors to heal those things up.
Yeah.
Because there's we're in crisis on the planet in a big way, in a scary way.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, people can begin by healing up their own ancestry and family system. You know, we can't control the living, but we can heal our relationship to family at least, and work out from there.
Right. Yeah. Because we are all connected, which is, you know, what you talked about in that passage. It really goes beyond the blood relative, you know, that we're all connected, so that we can in turn, you know, just heal the universe if we all kind of, you know, tap into this work in some way. You also talk about the importance of keeping a journal, and there's so much. People really need to read the book. And then you talk about honoring ancestors of place. If you could explain that a little bit.
Sure. Well, speaking as a North American of European ancestry, my ancestors participated in the colonization of what is traditionally Native North American tribal lands, and still is. And of course, many people of African ancestry didn't come voluntarily to the Americas, and nonetheless are swept up in a, you know, terrible colonialist way of being from European peoples generally. And so to be rooted in a sense of place is also to face the history of that place. And that doesn't mean staying stuck only on the pain, but acknowledging also the kinds of harms that have occurred toward earlier inhabitants of that land, unless any given individual is of Native ancestry from that place, in which case your people have a long relationship with the land there. And to have a deep connection with the earth where we live is important for our happiness. It's important for our health and our relationship with the larger web of life. And if we're endeavoring to do that, then we bump into how things got disconnected.
Yeah.
Like, when was the last time our people really were strongly earth connected? often it isn't in the Americas, depending on what your lineage is, you know, where they're from. And so that doesn't mean we can't have a intimate and deep, sustained relationship with the land where we live. It just means that we, to do so, we're invited to participate in the healing that's needed around the difficult history of colonialism and genocide in the Americas. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful work. And you give exercises in your book, an exercise for conscious participation in a burial and, you know, just all sorts of things. Now, can you tell us about your intensive weekend programs?
Sure. Yeah, I guide three-day trainings, and others I've trained are beginning to guide those as well. Like, there are ones coming up in Olympia, Washington, and Ottawa, Ontario, Phoenix, and other places. And that's an opportunity to move in a group way through what's in chapters 5 to 9 of the book, but it's a cycle of lineage repair work, of getting to know older ancestors along your bloodline, and to partner with them to bring about healing in the lineage between them and you. And so, so it's a way of being held by a facilitator in a group ritual process and bringing connection and healing to your bloodlines.
Yeah.
So I've been guiding those types of trainings since 2005, and I'm now starting to pass the torch on a bit to some of my students.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Really beautiful. Do you have anything to share that we have not covered, and any closing reflections? And of course, people should visit your website, ancestralmedicine.org.
Of course, visit the site. It's great. There's a lot of free resources there and a monthly newsletter I send out. And you know, the main thing coming up is the online course in this work that begins in October. But otherwise, just to be hopeful and encouraged that there's goodness and blessings and beauty in your blood lineages, even if your family is very difficult or harmful, and that you can bypass a lot of that trouble in the recent family to connect directly with those more ancient, available, wise and kind blessings.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And then you have this lovely poem here in your book by it's Denise, or it's actually Elise Derlam Ching.
Yeah,
it's beautiful. And if you don't mind, I'll just read that. It just seems appropriate for the closing.
Sure.
It says, when the rain begins, I say not to worry. One year there was no harvest. One day earth ripped apart like the gut of a sick deer. One moment I looked at myself in the eye of the moon, and I was afraid. Even she is being licked away by the black mouth of heaven. And next to her, this life is a small, dry stick burning. One year, the bear plunged among us, mad, and tore many lives before the arrow stopped his pain. I cried for us and for the bear. One day, ocean came across the land to our doorways, took some of us to feed his creatures, sent the rest of us into the mountains, leaving new gods among us. One moment, I looked down the chasm of the pass into the red river of my birth and readied myself to leave my children and their children. I grow old. Sun has clawed my face. Earth bent my spine. My eyes are clouded moons. My ears are closed to song and terror. Lay me in a plain canoe without ceremony, and when the moon is hidden and the rain begins, give me to the river, to the whims of stones and currents, and a violence that is natural and becoming. That's Elise Durlam Ching. Beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And you have wonderful exercises and some beautiful insights. And your book brings a much greater understanding to the work that you do in ancestral medicine. So thank you so much for that and for being here to share.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Take care.
Okay, you too.
I would like to thank our guest, Dr. Daniel Foer, for being here to discuss his book, Ancestral Medicine, Rituals for Personal and Family Healing. For more information, please visit ancestralmedicine.org. I would like to encourage all of our listeners to practice the universal law of giving by doing whatever you can to reach out to help others. To each and every one of you out there, thank you so much for joining me, Andrea Garrison, and connecting here online with Andrea. Listen to me live or listen to the archive. Just continue connecting heart to heart. But in the meantime, do whatever you can to reach out to help others and never underestimate the power of a friendly smile. Take care.
Thank you for connecting to Online with Andrea with your host, Andrea Garrison.